Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird Wilt.
And we are back with you, this time talking about Andor Season 2. This is our big Andor review episode. The show has just wrapped up last week as we sit down to record this, so it's fresh in our minds. We're going to talk about all the big themes, all the big events, and give you our take on, did it live up to the hype? Obviously, coming out of season one, it was considered by most people to be a phenomenal show, and there was a lot of questions about, can season two live up to those fan expectations that have been set? So we're here to talk about, did it live up to the hype? Did it exceed those expectations? And what did it leave us thinking about in terms of the future of Star Wars? So maybe we could go around and just each talk about our overall thoughts to kick things off, and then from there we can segue into some of these big moments. But Grace, what was your overall impression when the season ended? What did you think?
So, big sigh. So here's the thing. I liked season two. I thought it had some really great moments. Obviously, it was really well done. Great production value. I think there were a few moments where it lived up to the potential of season one, which I do think was basically a perfect season of television, not just of Star Wars, but in general. But I think ultimately it struggled to cohere. It was working too hard to fill in the gaps before getting to Rogue One. I wasn't happy with the way some of the characters' plot lines turned out. I feel like I would have been happy if we had only had a season one, because season two was fine, but it didn't fill me with the same kind of, wow, I'm watching something incredible that season one did. And even though it was good, just for that reason, for the not living up to season one, it was always going to be a disappointment to me. And then we'll get into the things that really, really annoyed me. and also things I liked, but I don't want to monopolize too much time.
I'll start with, I think it was like technically and artistically very masterful. The actors did very wonderful performances. I thought the like most of the writing was good after like the first half of the season. The first half, I will say, like, it was more, it was slower. It was characters talking more so than they probably needed to like fill in space and do character development somewhat more clumsily than they did in the first season. But my main complaint about Andor as a whole at this point is more philosophical. It's very much for me, like, you know, the quote from Interstellar where Matthew McConaughey is like, we used to look up at the stars and dream. Now we just dig around in the dirt. I feel like the first season of Andor, especially with Nemec's manifesto, promised a little bit more idealism than the show actually delivered in the end. So like season two, we always knew it was going to explore Luthen and moral compromises that he's making on like behalf of the rebellion and all of these things. And I think asking those questions is good. The total lack of idealism or like drawing a line in the sand on moral compromises, but like still having at the end Andor try to like provide an answer to whether Luthen was good really like sort of fell flat for me. So I'm thinking of the last episode. He's like, what does it matter how twisted he was? What does it matter what he did to us? Like, we wouldn't be here without him. And I just want to point out, like, that doesn't even align with Nemec's manifesto. Nemec's manifesto says like tyranny is not natural and freedom is like, it will ring. Like, freedom is going to ring eventually. And like individually across the galaxy, people are like rising up. And the conclusion to Andor season two is very much like, you know, without Luthen's embrace of the dark side, the rebellion and the light side wouldn't have been victorious, you know, briefly when Luke Skywalker conquers and all these things. And I found that very, like, not only nihilistic, but just, like, sort of blurred the lines between the light side and the dark side a little too much for my taste.
That's interesting. I did not expect both of you to have such strong criticisms of the season, because you know, as I was watching it, I think it totally delivered on its promise. I do think that the first story arc was a little slow, especially the part with Cassian on Yavin. But I think after that, we were off to the races, and every big story beat delivered, for me, an important theme about how the rebellion is coalescing, how the Empire, how that their cracks are starting to form in the edifice of the Empire. I thought that it did a good job of bringing the characters up to the point of Rogue One and subverting our expectations a little bit with some of them. And, you know, I understand, Haley, what you're saying about the moral compromises that Luthen makes, blurring the line a little bit. But I think from the beginning, it was pretty clear that the show wanted us to understand that you don't have a rebellion without people like him. And people like Vel doing what they did on Aldani. Like, Nemec's manifesto is great, but to me, I don't think we're meant to take that as, like, the God's honest truth. I think that's, like, one person's idealistic perspective, and I think it makes a lot of good points, like the importance of trying. But I do wonder whether it's a little too naive for Nemec to think that rebellion, the success of rebellion, is inevitable. I mean, you could parse it and say maybe what he's saying is just people who try to rebel, that part is inevitable. Their success is not inevitable. He does say that the Imperial need for control is unnatural, but that's not quite a guarantee that the Empire is going to collapse, not necessarily. So I think you could argue that what we see in season two is not inconsistent with what Nemec says, but I also think you could argue that Nemec's manifesto is not some core truth that is needs to be vindicated by the show.
So I'm going to totally push back against, like, literally everything you were saying. I think the importance of Nemec's manifesto, and I don't want to get too in the weeds here, but I think it was reaffirmed by the show itself, because at the very last episode, you have Partagaz listening to it, and the message is that, you know, this manifesto is inescapable. It's spread everywhere, and even in the very halls of the ISB, you can't escape Nemec's manifesto. Where my issue was with Luthen, some of it didn't really ring true to me. And that speech in particular from Cassian to the rebel leaders, as you were saying, Haley, that there is a reason that fell flat to me. Diego Luna's wonderful actor, did a wonderful job this season. But you're saying to Bail Organa, to Mon Mothma, who have been in the trenches for literally decades of fighting back against the Empire, and before that, the corruption within the Republic, you're telling them that the rebellion would be nowhere without Luthen. I think it is a really interesting tension, because I do think you can't have the rebellion without everything that Luthen did, but you can't have the rebellion without everything that Bail and Mon did as well. So that was why that fell flat to me.
The reason I sound extra frustrated with Luthen is, like, in season one, I think a lot of his decisions were more like they felt forced by circumstances surrounding them. So, like, leaving the rebel group, you know, to get, you know, caught by the Imperials in season one. That was like a strategic decision protecting, like, the operations. Killing Lonnie Young, who, like, has been giving him information loyally for years instead of even trying to get him off the planet, that really, like, bothered me. It was just so for the convenience of it. He, like, Luthen does not even care about human life near the end.
Okay,
One more thing, Eric. The Gorman massacre, Luthen is rooting for it because they are wealthy and influential, and he says they will burn brightly when they die. And, like, these are things that are not necessary for, like, actually having the rebellion. These are not circumstances forced upon him. This is, like, his mind has been warped, and he admits this in his, like, Shakespearean monologue, but it just was so much even clearer this season, just, like, how he views people as pawns and does not actually, like, respect. He's just so far removed from the actual values of, like, freedom and, like, Nemec's, like, manifesto. He is just, like, an echo of the Empire wreaking chaos and death wherever he goes. And, like, I didn't love that.
So if I could just defend Cassian and Luthen a little bit.
And I'm not mad at Cassian. I honestly, I think the like the showrunners put that little speech in the, like before the council in there to like, I don't think it was necessary, but it was like to provide some like closure or like answer. And I think the show would have been so much better without an answer, because the question of like how far is too far is a good question to ask. And you should leave audiences like wondering. And I think it was just a little too like trite.
So first on Lonnie, there's no way he's getting him off planet. That man has fallen apart.
But
so
they got
that's
Clea
not,
off planet.
Clea held it together. She's a professional. Lonnie was out over his skis. That's not happening. Luthen's got to think of the rebellion first. But the other thing I'll say.
How can Luthen decide which person is going to make it?
It's his network. It's his network. He is not taking any chances, especially with the intel that he has now, which is the most important thing in the galaxy. The other thing I'll say is, I don't know if maybe we're seeing the they'll burn brightly thing about Gorman differently, but my read is he's not saying I want them to die because they're rich and I hate rich people. He's saying if they die, since they're so famous and influential, more people will start to care about
what's happening.
I wasn't confused on that point.
I know that's what he was saying. I promise.
I don't think that is the most outrageous thing I've ever heard. I mean, people consciously fight back all the time knowing that they have very little chance of success, but their efforts will inspire others. And the people on Gorman, at least in the Gorman front, were very aware that they were fighting an uphill battle. Now, the rest of the populace was not aware that they were pawns in some game here. But it's not as if everybody on Gorman is just like walking into a trap without any sense of wanting to fight back. There's people there who very much want to resist and want to stand up and aren't sure if they're going to succeed, but want to, in a sense, burn brightly for the galaxy to see. I mean, there's that speech that Drina gives at the end of The Massacre where she's saying, pay attention to us. So they're aware that their sacrifice only means something if other people see it. And that is what Luthen is hoping for. It doesn't make him a good guy, but it does mean that the success of a movement like this does not happen without people like him. And if the last thing I'll say is, you know, I think Grace was the one who said Mon and Bail are in the trenches and have been for years. I love Mon Mothma. She had the best, in my opinion, the best arc in the show. She has not been in the trenches. Bail has not been in the trenches. Neither of them has fired a weapon for this rebellion. And you can stand in the Senate and you can speak all you want, but you are not going to win a war giving speeches. And that is the lesson of this show, that it is not all about help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope, and Mon Mothma standing up there and speaking to the Senate. It is about people down in the dirt doing unsavory things. That is the only way you win a war.
So first of all, I agree that Mon's arc was probably the strongest, but I feel like I may be in the middle ground between you two in terms of enjoying Luthen's arc, because as previously established, Grace loves dark things. So like personally, me seeing Luthen go increasingly insane and making these really like dark choices, I'm like, heck yeah, let's bring it, let's have it. It's really fun for me to see, because you know, it's so he clearly is, as the rebellion leaders say, he's paranoid. And we can argue that it's worth it. His paranoia has a reason, but he is making choices that he knows will harm people. And I would push back against two things that you said, Eric. First of all, I do think that Luthen did want not the Gorman massacre to occur per se, but he did want there to be some sort of violence that would have the rest of the galaxy paying attention.
Yes, I agree with that. That's what I was saying.
Okay, but I thought you were saying that he doesn't actually want them to be harmed, because
he doesn't want them to die because they're rich, which is what I thought Haley was saying, but we clarified.
No, I was saying because they're rich and wealthy and influential, I think he was making the point that they would burn so brightly, as in like people would notice.
Yes.
Yeah, they would pay attention to them.
Yes. I just find that like a repugnant way to view like human life. They should not be pawns
the point
in the game. Like, and Eric,
Haley, I wasn't done. So I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Grace.
No. I feel like we're all really passionate about
this.
It's
time to fight.
After all this time, it's time to finally fight. So the other thing I was going to say is I don't think that the people of Gore, yes, they were ready to fight, but I don't necessarily think that they were ready to become symbols of rebellion. I don't think that's what they wanted. I think they just wanted their planet back. They just wanted their culture back. And I really liked the people of Gore and their crazy not French language. That was wild. Shout out to all the actors
they
who memorized that
job.
Language.
Those yes. were French actors, by the way.
Yes, I did know that, but like they're speaking, it's like we were speaking a language that sounded like English, but wasn't. That's bonkers.
Totally.
But I loved the little hotel bellhop talking about the importance of rebellion, but I don't think anyone would, well, maybe some people would choose to be martyrs, but I think
some
that
people do. We know that from
some
the
people,
real world.
We do know that. But I don't think that the hundreds of people who were there in Gorman Square actively wanted to be martyrs.
I think the only person in there who knew that they were about to be killed was Cyril Karn. He went out there to die, and then he like saw Andor and flipped out. But like when we're talking about tragic stories, I think Cyril's storyline there was just pitch perfect. Like that is one thing that they did very, very well.
Yeah, so Grace, if you want to just finish up, you can. But then I was going to say, I would love to talk about some of the specific character arcs and what we liked and what we didn't like. Maybe we could start with Cassian. He's the title character. What did you guys think about the arc he has? Maybe I'll go first this time, just very quickly, give you guys something to presumably disagree with. But I did like seeing how he gets better at a couple of things in season two. So he becomes a better spy. We see the trade craft. He's better at being undercover and persuading people to work with him and stuff. But also you see him grow more loyal to the cause. He actually starts to care about not only what he's fighting for, but also who he's fighting with. So you see him eventually align with Yavin, and he's still defending who Luthen is and what he represents, but he's also very much a Yavin rebel by the end of the show, even if he's still pretty hot-headed. What I wasn't expecting was the way that Bix served in the story as kind of a distraction for him towards the end, clouding his judgment about the mission, and I'm sure we'll have a lot to say about where Bix ends up at the end of the season, including at the very end of the season, but I was not expecting that kind of emotional attachment question to be presented for him here. I assumed that she would die at some point and he wouldn't have to confront this question, but I thought that was very interesting. I know there's been a lot of discussion about, like, does it make sense for Cassian to visit the Force Healer and find out that he has a destiny? I do think it's a little bit too Joseph Campbell, Luke Skywalker for destiny to be brought into this, but I do think that it's realistic for somebody to be told, hey, you're going places, and to kind of instinctively pull back from that, to reject that, to say, I decide where I go. So I like that, him wrestling with that. And then as we talked about, you know, he really doesn't see eye to eye with the leadership on Yavin, even though he knows that's where he needs to be. And the tension there of, this is the movement that I need to be part of, but the people in charge, they don't understand these things that I think they need to understand. That is a great layer of texture to add to our understanding of what Yavin is, which we don't get a lot of nuance on kind of up until season two of Andor. So have it at it. Disagree away.
Yeah. Here I am disagreeing immediately. So as you say, titular character, Cassian Andor, I would have loved if he remained the main character in season two, which I do not think that he did. And obviously there were a whole bunch of different characters in season one. They all had their different arcs. They all had their different moments, but Cassian was still very much the focal point. He was the nexus around which we were understanding the origins of the rebellion. And I do not think that was at all the case in season two. And that I found that really disappointing. One of my favorite moments happened in the very beginning of season two, where he is talking to this young Imperial worker about the importance that she is playing in the rebellion. And that to me is not only what Andor the show is about, which is not just like we're getting down in the dirt in the muck. I think that it's both. It's about, yes, we are getting down in the dirt in the muck, but we are also doing this for hope. We are also doing this because we believe it can be better. And we believe that one person's individual action can make a difference. And that's what Cassian is saying to this woman. I think her name is Nia. And it's just such a powerful, beautiful moment. And I think really a thesis statement for the show and for his character. And then next thing you know, he's stuck on a planet for 3 episodes, not doing anything. and I just thought that was very emblematic of how, you know, his character, he kept being sidelined throughout the season. I also did not enjoy at all how his character was defined by Bix, how Bix's character was defined by him. I thought that was a real mistake. I honestly would have much, much preferred it if they had not been together at all. I had ended season one with the impression that they were not getting together. And I think that them spending so much time being preoccupied with each other was a real disservice and flattening to both of their characters, especially hers, but also to his. And I was just, I wanted more. I wanted more Andor in my Andor.
I don't have such strong opinions about him. I find him so endearing, and I thought he did such a good job with his scenes. I agree that the first 3 episodes were very frustrating for me. I was like, what's he doing on this planet with these doofuses? For so many episodes. But like the rest of it for me was good. The only thing that fell flat is the little speech at the end, like trying to tie up Luthen's story in a nice little bow. Like, I don't think that was necessary. But again, like people are working through it. Like he's a character who just witnessed some like very tragic things. So I'll give him a pass. I think they're naturally kind of constrained on his story arc and character development because you're moving toward something we've already seen before. Like you're leading up to the very beginning of Rogue One. I will say, like, I really enjoyed the, like, they got the hair really perfect. Like
they did. And they did get it right.
I thought the costume, all of it was great. Like they de-aged, like somehow it was like, oh my goodness, it's about to be Rogue One. I don't know how, it was magic. Whoever was doing the hair and the makeup and all of this. So I don't have that many big feelings about Andor beyond like, I did not fully grasp how he went from being just totally devastated by Bix leaving to like, maybe I'll talk to her in a couple of years or something, like in the last episode. that was bizarre to me. I have nothing against a love story. I thought it was beautiful. Whatever. Be happy together. And I do think it's very realistic for someone to not want to be at war and would rather be with someone they love in a very safe place. Like, I think that's a very realistic character issue that Andor was having. I wish Bix had stayed with him. That's my opinion. But I don't really understand how he got around to like kind of cooling off from that very like passionate love and like sort of interdependent relationship.
I was really frustrated this season by how he kept being like, I'm out, I'm in, I'm out, I'm in. Because end of season one, he's like, kill me or take me in. He's all in. And I do think it's natural to want to give up a life for someone that you love. I think that makes a lot of sense. But I rewatched Rogue One after I finished Andor season two. Side note, the second half of Rogue One is among the best Star Wars has ever been. First half, messy as heck. The second half, incredible. But there's this moment that he has with Jyn where he goes, suddenly the rebellion is real to you. Some of us don't have that luxury. I've been in this fight since I was 6 years old. And it's like, oh, suddenly the rebellion is real to you when your girlfriend broke up with you. That just seemed inconsistent to me that he kept being out and in and out and in. And I also, oh God, I'm going to go off on such a rant, so I'll stop talking here.
Well,
but
so can I just say one thing about back and forth? That was one of the things that stood out to me as the most confusing and the weakest part of the season is there's even the episode where Willman comes to them and says, like, Luthen wants you to kill Dedra. Cassian is like, what are you doing, man? Going off to deal with Luthen? Like, go check in with the Yavin folks. Like, we're here for a reason. Like, this is where we need to be. And then, like, 5 minutes later, he's going to Gorman to assassinate Dedra. Like, no explanation of why he changed his mind about that. So, and that's just, like, one moment. There's multiple moments in that whole arc where he's having the conversation with Clea, and she's trying to convince him to stay in. And then he's talking to Bix, and he's like, I'm ready to leave. I couldn't understand what was motivating him to stay or go. I think the best you can do is say that he is being buffeted by all these forces that are affecting him moment to moment, and he doesn't have a consistent frame of mind about what he wants to do. But, Grace, if you want to go off on a rant, can I guess, is this rant about Bix?
You're so right. You know me so well. Can I go off on my Bix rant? Can I do it?
Do
can
it.
Go off? Yes, go ahead.
Okay. So first of all, let's set aside the trope that a girlfriend is secretly pregnant, but the dad doesn't find out because he dies or she doesn't tell him and she leaves him. Like, let's just set aside that not only is that trope boring and overplayed, it has been done in Star Wars before, like more than once. Let's set it aside because I hate that trope, but I'm not even going to be talking about that trope. So I was so disappointed by Bix's characterization this season. In season one, she is established as a competent mechanic. She is established as someone with very strong values. Season two, the beginning, we see her as doing mechanic stuff on the farm planet. And I did think it was really powerful for Andor to confront the ideas of illegal immigration and sexual assault, and how undocumented women are particularly vulnerable to sexual assault. I think this is the first time we've ever heard the word rape in Star Wars.
Yeah.
When she said, he tried to rape me, I thought that was very, very powerful. But you have a character who has already ended season one extremely traumatized. Now she gets re-traumatized. She spends the next three episodes becoming a drug addict and not doing anything in response to this trauma. And then her entire arc in episodes 7 through 9 is being there for Cassian, like helping him make decisions, convincing him to see the Force Healer. Like, she has no agency on her own whatsoever beyond what Cassian is doing. And there's this hint, like, she could have been part of the rebellion in her own right. She's going on missions. And I would have been so, so happy if clearly she cared about the rebellion so much. And if she had broken up with Cassian by being, listen, I love you, but the rebellion is really important to me and I need it to be important to you, so I'm going to go off undercover and do my own rebellion missions, that would have been great. But no, she's just leaving because she's pregnant and because, you know, she doesn't have an existence outside of him, and he just needs to be a part of the rebellion, and she's just a distraction from that. And this just, you completely took away all of the characterization that made her an individual person and made her entirely dependent on Cassian, and in doing so made Cassian's character development almost entirely dependent on her, which, as I said before, I think was a disservice to him. But just ending it the way that they did, I know it was supposed to be the sense of hope that, you know, the next generation is being healthy and happy in the world that Cassian is building. But to me, it just felt like, you know, here's one more female character who could have had agency and a plotline of her own, and we decided to sideline her for the sake of her male love interest. I think Adria Arjona did a wonderful job with the character. Her monologue as Bix was really incredible. I think all of the acting in the show is phenomenal, and she did a great job. But I was just so, so, so very disappointed by everything that they did with her character. That's my rant.
Haley, what do you think?
I was going to ask what you think, Eric.
Well, I'm torn because, first of all, I agree about the last scene. Incredibly frustrating to see, first of all, to see Bix defined as, I think I said in my review online, like, just the bearer of Cassian's spawn. Like, really
exactly.
unfortunate choice there. But then also just, like, to take away from the ending being about Cassian. I mean, we're literally going into Rogue One. The ending should be about Cassian. And so you're going to Bix? Like, what is that? That's weird. But in terms of Bix's characterization overall, I'm torn between seeing it the way Grace sees it and wanting to see something pay off from the promise of who Bix was in season one, and then thinking there is something realistic about a person who has a lot of promise being sidelined by trauma, like having trauma affect them in a way where they do spiral. It's not pleasant and it's not fulfilling, but it feels realistic to me. It feels like a person could go through what she went through, and I don't know whether to criticize that on the basis of it wasn't the Bix I wanted, or to admit that it was an interesting choice on the basis of this can happen to people and it's frustrating to watch, but I imagine that this is an experience that people live through, and not everybody gets the hero's journey of Cassian Andor.
So here's the thing. Yes, that is correct. It is an interesting development. We have seen women in media be traumatized in this way so many times. Like, I can't even count the number of times I have been watching something where a woman character experiences trauma, in especially with regard to sexual assault and how she really struggles with that. And it is how things happen in the real world. But for me, what made Andor so interesting was how it would subvert tropes and take away from what you expected it to do. And the plot line where woman gets traumatized and re-traumatized and re-traumatized and re-traumatized, like, that's not, you know, the revolutionary, hard-hitting storytelling that men always seem to think that it is. And I know I'm getting passionate, and I'm not mad at you, Eric. But
she's mad at Tony Gilroy.
I'm mad at Tony Gilroy. Like, women can exist as characters without being defined by their trauma. It is possible. And I think, you know, I loved the development that she had in the previous season with her being tortured at the end of it. And I thought that was really powerful and moving. But it's just like, I have seen this story before, just like with her being secretly pregnant at the end. Like, I have seen this movie before. It's not new anymore. It's not interesting. And like, yes, it's realistic, sure. But I wanted Andor to be better. I wanted it to be new and interesting and do something different. And to me, this is just so painfully, painfully played out. And like, not the only woman character whose development I was really unsatisfied with. Like, you know, for every Mon and Clea, who both had phenomenal arcs this season, then you had Vel and Cinta, who I feel like were really dealt with unfairly. I mean, you're right, Eric. Of course, it's a realistic and interesting thing to portray. It's just been done so many times, and I'm just sick of seeing women re-traumatized for the narrative because it's realistic.
I was just so grateful they didn't kill her off for, like, Andor's character development. I really thought that was coming. Like, that's very much the, like, gladiator, Braveheart kind of male road to greatness, is to have a woman you really love killed by a tyrannical government. So I was fearful of that outcome, and I was happy it did not happen, that she seems to be the only survivor. I don't have as many strong opinions about this. I definitely knew she was pregnant before she left. There were vibes.
Interesting.
It was when they were like, she was like checking his shoulder, and like there was a flirting moment going on. It was very much like, this is a couple that's together and like has plans for a future, and she's probably pregnant kind of moment in my mind. So I was not at all surprised by the ending. I do think motherhood is not sidelining as much as, like, Grace, I agree that it's frustrating in media, but like, motherhood has a lot of challenges, and like you're bringing a whole new being into the world. And so I do think it makes sense if she wanted to have kids and was pregnant at that moment when I assumed she was, and like realized that leaving was the only way for, you know, one of them to stay in the cause and the other to like protect the baby. So I don't mind it. I think it's fine. I think it's kind of cool that she gets to survive. I really was worried she was going to get killed off there.
The one thing I think might have improved the ending of the story for Bix is if instead of doing this whole thing where you have a destiny and you need to stay on your path, so I'm going to leave, if they said, so Grace, one option was what you said, which is I'm going to go do my rebel missions. I think the other option is closer to what we actually saw, which is I want peace. You don't even have to bring the kid into it. Just like, I'm done. Like, this is too much for me. I thought this was what I wanted in a life. I need peace and calm and safety, as so many people do. It's not a moral failing. It's not a sign of weakness. This is just not for you. And so for her, I think if she had just said, like, I can't do this anymore, then they could have had interesting tension over Cassian feeling like he needs to stay. And they could still have Bix out of the picture, but it's not about Cassian. It's about what she wants and what she needs.
Yeah, I would never say, like, that ending up a mother is a bad ending for someone. I just get frustrated when it feels like people think that's the only possible ending for a woman. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I fully get the complaint, and like I don't know. I think where I dislike the way her like story arc ended is that, like, I was reading an interview from Tony Gilroy about, like, I just wanted to like have a little element of hope there at the end. Like, that's the reason for that decision, and it's very vibes based. and I almost think it's like correcting for the very nihilistic moral relativism that's in the last episode of like, but look, here's the generation that gets to enjoy a brief moment of freedom before the First Order comes along, thanks to all Luthen's immoral killings. Like,
we can't bring up the sequels. I'll go insane.
Grace is primed. You just can't. You can't mention Rey Palpatine.
You can't do it.
I will mention the sequels. Because was it all worth it? That's the thing. Is like the
no, it wasn't, and that's the terrible thing about the sequels.
So like Nations Rise and Fall, and like Luthen lost his. All of his sense of morality and like even sense of self in pursuit of something so fleeting.
Lonnie Young died so that General Hux could be the new redhead.
Right. Lonnie deserved better.
So we were talking about Bix and a disappointing story arc. But Grace, you mentioned a character who gets a really, in my opinion, really interesting story arc, especially in the second season, Kleya. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about how Kleya defines herself separately from Luthen, because we've talked about Luthen. If you guys have anything else you want to say about Luthen, let's definitely start there. But what did you think of how Kleya steps into her own in season two?
I liked how her hair was different than it was in season one. I did not like her hairstyle in season one that much, and it changed a lot in this one, and it looked better. It looked more sophisticated. It looked more chic. I really didn't like how tragic her ending was. But there was a note of hope at the end there. There was a brief, like, flicker of a smile crossing her face as she considered staying with the people at Yavin.
I think she has one of the most complex journeys in the second season because, you know, we start off, we don't know her relationship to Luthen. And we start to see, especially in the first half of the season, especially with that little mission that they go on to take the bug out of Skulden's gallery, she's the one pushing him to take risks. And she's the one a little more ambitious, a little more hard-edged. Luthen is almost, he's not losing his nerve, but he's becoming a little more cautious. And then we start to see her, especially once we find out the backstory, we realize that really Luthen has sort of taught her everything he knows, but he has molded her from a much younger age than he was molded into this weapon, really. I mean, he builds her into a weapon, and then she's got to use all the skills that she develops to ultimately to take Luthen's life for the good of the cause. I mean, the psychodrama wrapped up in that is It's an excellent storyline to me. I really appreciated that they made her more than just his assistant, that they explained where she came from and threaded that through into the present in a way that makes you appreciate everything she's had to do. Just like Luthen is talking about the sacrifices he's had to make, Clea doesn't give a speech like that, but you understand that she's done the same thing at his side, and now she's got to operate alone on this last mission. And then, as you said, Haley, that's kind of it for her. She's almost pulled along by Cassian to Yavin. She's kind of given up by that point. As long as she passes on the intel, she doesn't need to go anywhere. But then she shows up there and she's out of place. People don't like her because she's associated with Luthen. She disdains the whole operation. But then she does start to see, as you mentioned, hey, maybe Luthen and I, maybe we made it worth it, in Cassian's words. Maybe this is all going somewhere promising. And I do think that she deserves to see the organization and the sophistication and the seriousness, and to feel vindicated by her role in making that happen. I think she's done so much for the cause. The least that she deserves is to see this is going somewhere and to, again, feel a little bit of hope. I think there is an element of hope there at the end that we're making it worth it, and I was an essential part of that.
One more thing I want to say is, like, it does, her upbringing and backstory really emphasizes kind of the point I'm making about Luthen, which is that, like, what he said was he's, like, using the tools of his enemy. He very much raises her like a Sith Padawan, like, very much focus on your rage and your resentment. Don't let go of it. Don't forget what you're saying. Like, it is not the Jedi way in any sense. And when I say the, like, the brief flicker of hope there at the end, like, and why I think she feels so much skepticism of Yavin is there, like, it is a different way of resisting there. And it's not just bureaucracy or more rules to follow. Like, I think there are more ethical considerations at play than there were when it was just her and Luthen, you know, roaming around the galaxy.
So my favorite episode was probably episode 8. My second favorite episode was probably episode 10, which is the episode where we get Clea's backstory and she goes on that mission to kill Luthen. I agree with both of you. I think, you know, it's a fascinating backstory. And then I think it's so interesting to see her on Yavin and seeing the rebellion that she helped make and learning that there's more than one way to do a rebellion, and that the mutual disdain that she and Luthen in the Alliance have for each other, you know, ultimately they're working for the same goal. And I think that's a really fascinating development. The other character that I probably, like I said before, the character whose arc I liked the most over this season was probably Mon. Genevieve O'Reilly is just so wonderful in the role. And some of my favorite moments were Mon moments. So Mon dancing at her daughter's wedding, obviously her speech before the Senate, and then just seeing her on Yavin with the new haircut, just going into this new role. I thought that her arc from being Senate leader to true rebel was really, really fascinating and one of my favorite parts of the season. Also, her costumes are phenomenal.
Can I just say her speech in the Senate could have been so much more tightly written? I don't know why there was, like, so much throat clearing at the beginning. It was like, I've been here for so long. It's like, no, get to the point.
That's interesting. I thought it was actually pretty short for the significance of the moment. And I agree with you, Grace, that, for me, Mon's arc is the best of the season. She's my favorite character in the season. The things that she experiences and witnesses, it really is a credible depiction of a person who's ending up where she ends up in Rogue One. But it's also revealing things about her that we would never have guessed, right? So the whole, you know, the Tay Kolma's betrayal and sort of her having to grapple with that and what it does for her relationship with Luthen, that was fascinating. Obviously, the wedding is this element of, it's very sad for her that she has to put her daughter through this. You know, the whole, her the intersection between her and Gorman I thought was great. I love the scene where she's trying to get the senators to join her on this fight against what's happening on Gorman, and they basically tell her, like, look, this is a political loser of an issue. One of them even says, like, I don't really believe the statistics that you're giving me. Like, I believe what I feel when it comes to the threat posed by Gorman, which, like, great political allegory there for our current times. The role that she plays as this lone voice of sanity in the wilderness, and then souring on this place, and then having to go somewhere that, again, as I said at the beginning, completely out of her element, not a world that she's able to operate in or used to operating in, and then learning to operate there. And even by the end of it, kind of taking Luthen's, not his full side, but at least siding with him on the question of, do we trust the intelligence from Lonnie? That journey for her, gaining that hard edge, you know, watching Cassian gun people down right in front of her face as she flees the Senate. I never thought we would see that level of detail of how Mon Mothma truly joins the rebellion. And I say that, I know it's controversial. She has been a fighter for the principles of the rebellion for a long time, but this is when she actually joins the Rebel Alliance, in my opinion. And seeing that unspooled and watching her basically give up on politics in a sense, or at least imperial politics, exquisitely done, basically no notes.
I really, like I said, I just loved her arc. I would argue that no, she wasn't part of the rebellion as it was. I would argue that rebellion as it was would not exist without her, even with all of the machinations of Luthen. I mean, Luthen's machinations couldn't exist without her. That was a huge part of season one. Like she's been in this, but we can sort of split hairs over to what extent. One thing that I thought was really freaking funny is how she basically just, like, left her husband, and that was not even a concern, like, not mentioned once in that episode. Her husband was not mentioned at all. I know, like, they had talked about making him part of it and that he actually knew about the rebellion, but I just still thought, and I would have liked to see that, but I think it was very, very funny that he just was not in it at all.
When they showed him in the montage at the end, I literally said to myself, oh, that's right, she's married. I was like, oh, yeah, she had a husband who she just left behind and straight up didn't say anything about, which is perfect, really. That's exactly what Perrin deserves.
Yeah, I was fine with it.
All right, well, let's talk about Cyril and Dedra, because for me, this is definitely the weirdest part of the season. Even after all the shipping that happened after season one, I thought to myself, there's no way they're actually going to make these two people have a romantic relationship. These are not romantic people. These are these are people who are devoted to the job. And just because they share some semblance of an ideology does not mean that they're going to be boyfriend and girlfriend and having dinner with Cyril's mom. But that's exactly what we got. And while I did think that the scene with Edie, where Dedra basically lays out the situation for her, was extremely funny, I did not like this relationship. I did not understand what it was adding to the story. It didn't seem in character with either of them to have any time for a romantic relationship. So that was just, I don't know. That was weird. What did you guys think?
So I enjoyed it. I thought their story arcs were some of the best in the entire show. I mean, very tragic, but like done perfectly, I think. I don't mind the romantic relationship because I think, like, lost people find each other and they stay lost together.
But they weren't, like, lost. Like, Dedra had a purpose.
No, but Cyril, her purpose is a total, like, denial.
It was a bad purpose. Like, she was obsessed with finding Axis, but she had a purpose.
I think the reason their relationship makes sense to me is that they're both, like, striving for promotion and, like, job success, and they kind of see each other as, like, pathways to that. So, like, Cyril has, like, more of a role at whatever big, whatever that thing was, whatever his job was, he's gotten a promotion. Dedra is always trying to get promotions, and honestly, they see themselves as, like, a power couple rising through the ranks of the Empire. So, like, that's a real thing that, like, they see each other as, like, partners in climbing the corporate ladder. And I would never say that they're the most romantic people. I did not see a whiff of romance between those two, even when they were together on the screen, which, like, that's fine. It's very pragmatic. It makes sense that two people trying to advance career-wise around the same, roughly the same age, going through the same, like, traumatic circumstances on Ferrix would stay together. Like, I'm not bothered by that. I think their fight on Gorman was, like, one of the best moments of the show in episode 8. Just, like, Cyril being betrayed by essentially the Empire that he had devoted himself to, and finding out that the Empire is not actually the representative of justice and order that he thought it was. And, like, Dedra symbolizes that for him, of, like, order and justice and this commitment to the Empire, and she personally betrays him. I think it made it so much more visceral for him to have that reaction in the context of that personal relationship. That was one of my favorite parts of the whole season.
I wholly agree with you on that front, Haley, about their relationship. That's what made it really hit Cyril. This is just the Grace Disagrees with Eric show.
Eric, I'm sorry.
No, it's good. We need to fight occasionally. Otherwise, where's the spice?
This is what keeps the listeners coming back.
Yeah, this is the occasional, very mild argument. I really liked their relationship. I would agree with Haley that I think Dedra is very lost, because we know that she is an orphan. We know that she craves purpose, she craves order, and she craves advancement. And much as Dedra represents the Empire to Cyril, I think for Dedra, Cyril represents, like, a part of her life that she can control, a way that she can pretend to be normal and check the boxes of a relationship, but then also, like, have this sort of status of being in a relationship with this man who absolutely worships her, and then being able to use him for her own ends. But I do think that she genuinely cares about him, as seen in that episode 8, where she's like, we can finally have everything. And I think she sees Cyril as part of having everything.
She already had everything when she got Cyril.
For Cyril, I did love how Cyril almost gets it. Like, he almost sees what the Empire is. He almost understands. He is on the absolute brink of it. And then he sees Cassian, and all that he can remember is his rage. I loved that. I thought that was very realistic. Like, even he had everything. He had all the evidence in front of him. And all he can see is the man who he has convinced ruined his life. And the last thing he knows is that that man doesn't even know who he is. Like, this, he has dedicated so much of his life to Cassian and been convinced that they were mortal enemies. And then the last thing is Cassian going, "Who are you?" Like, I thought that was really brilliant and really great tragic ending for Cyril.
One more thing on that exact scene. I want to give him a little bit more credit. Yes, he responds with pure rage to Andor, and they, like, get into this big fight, and he inadvertently saves Dedra again. He did go out there to die. Like, I'm going to give him credit on that. He knew what was about to happen, that it was a massacre that the Empire had basically engineered, and that, like, those people were doomed. He went and stood out there with them, and, like, he knew what he was getting into. I don't think he expected to survive that standoff. I think he was so shaken by, like, his entire view of the Empire being upended, that he was just, like, furious, went out there to die with the people that he had, like, been feeding information to.
I don't think he went out there to die. I think he was just in shock. I think he would have just run away had he come out of his shock. I mean, after what he's just learned, his whole world has been turned upside down. But I don't think he then goes to, like, solidarity with the Gorrimmons. I think he's like, I gotta get the heck out of here. And then, as Gray says, he sees Cassian and totally agreed, like, that is one of the best parts of the show, is him being so close to not only getting it, but also getting away and being free to live whatever life he wants, and then being grabbed by the tractor beam of his vendetta. And again, for it to be unreciprocated is the ultimate indignity for him, especially because of how much he's put into this. I thought that was so tragic.
The other thing I love just about that scene specifically before we move on is how after Cassian says, "Who are you?" he lowers his gun and begins to drop his gun. And we don't know. We don't know if that means that Cyril has it got through to him. We don't know. We don't know what it means, and we never will know. And I love that, too.
And then Dedra's story arc is also very tragic because we see her, you know, in season one, she has that that showdown with the other supervisor who basically says, your creative freelancing is a threat to the Empire. And that kind of ends with her girl bossing her way to victory. And we go, you know, great, you know, she's actually being creative and operating outside of the stodgy bureaucracy. And that's kind of a good thing, although not really. But then in season two, that's what dooms her. That guy was right. Her obsession with catching Axis leads her to do all these things that in the inflexible mind of the Imperial bureaucracy is misread as her being a rebel spy. And because of the system she's operating in, a system that she has helped perpetuate, she cannot explain herself. She is not believed. Everything she says reinforces Krennic's belief that she's a rebel spy, and she ultimately ends up right there in a shoeless prison wearing the jumpsuit. I mean, that is just perfection to me, is watching her taken down by the system and the very specific elements of the system that she has helped to perpetuate. Just like when she interrogated Bix on Ferrix, and Bix said, "You're not going to believe me no matter what I say." And Dedra said, "Yep, that's right." And that is the system that dooms her.
She girl boss too close to the sun.
Yeah, that's tough. By the way, just to go back to what you guys were saying about this is the everybody disagrees with Eric episode. I think we've already established that, much like Mon Mothma, you know, sometimes when everybody is criticizing you and disagreeing with you, ultimately what it means is that you are in the right and history will see you as the true hero. So I just want to put that out there for this episode.
One thing about Dedra's story arc, but someone on the internet, I think it was Twitter, it might have been Substack, so I apologize to whoever you are because I don't know who you are. Someone pointed out that the Rebel Alliance and Luthen's operation sort of emphasizing that they have friends everywhere and expanding community is the total opposite of advancement within the Imperial bureaucracy. The higher up you get, the more isolated you are, and you're very much very, very fiercely judged based on performance. Partagaz's ending, that very tragic, but also it emphasizes the difference between Andor showing up randomly after breaking all the rules and the people on Yavin coming around and listening to him versus Partagaz failing and feeling like he needs to end it. I don't know, it's a very inhuman system versus a alliance that is built on community and essentially having friends everywhere.
Yeah, and ultimately that is the difference between fascism and democracy, is that one of those systems is flexible enough to accommodate these kinds of idiosyncrasies, and the other one is built, as Nemec said, on this brittle foundation where this kind of creativity, if you don't treat that as a security threat, you will not survive as a fascist system. So you have to crack down. You can't take chances. And I thought that was another excellent layer to it. Well, let's talk about a few of the other characters before we wrap things up here. Grace, you mentioned earlier Vel and Cinta, and I have a feeling you have some thoughts about their story arc in season two. Do you want to just address, is obviously, so spoilers for people who haven't seen it. I don't know why you're listening to this show, but so Cinta dies, obviously. Is this an example of the trope that I believe is referred to as bury your gaze?
No, it is not. And I am speaking from a very like literal textual standpoint of the trope bury your gaze. Bury your gaze typically means that the death of a queer character is used like purely as shock value and then not treated with any particular weight. And I do think that Cinta's death is treated with weight and solemnity. Like, I understand that everybody dies. That's kind of the point of the rebellion. Like that a lot of people die. A lot of people die in Rogue One. Like people die. I wish that a queer woman of color had gotten a better send off, more screen time. It just felt very abrupt to me how quickly she was killed off, and we never really learned anything about her backstory, especially after she was really set up in season one as a side character, to be sure, not a main by any sense, but a character who was going to be a part of the rebellion going forward. And I think I understand the purpose that her death played in the narrative, and I think Faye Marseille does a really wonderful job with her speech about Cinta's death as Vel. But I feel like you can't separate the show from the real world, and that's part of the show's strengths. But that means when you kill off a queer woman of color character, like that doesn't exist in the vacuum of everybody dies in this show, which first of all, not everybody does die, although a lot of people do. Like it exists in the context of the real world where the rights of LGBTQ people are under assault and where women of color are especially marginalized. Like I understand the role that her death played. I think it was well done. I am happy that actress is on Doctor Who. And so I can see her elsewhere, but it just to me was like, okay, of course you kill off the lesbian. Like, fine, whatever. So that was my frustration.
The one thought I had about Vel and Cinta that I don't know if it's gotten quite as much pickup as some of the other things is, you know, Cinta has that moment when they're talking, their last night together, I guess, and she's talking about how, like, yeah, I got this injury, like, I should have, like, pulled back from going on these missions. I basically saying, like, I didn't know my own limits, and that was a mistake. And then later you see how Vel has internalized that when she's talking to, is it Bix? Or Mon, maybe, in the last episode, I guess? But she's talking about basically, like, I needed to pace myself, which is like why I came here and started doing what I'm doing on Yavin. And I did appreciate that for somebody who goes as hard as Vel does, seeing her internalize that lesson from Cinta and almost keep Cinta alive with that lesson and say like, this person who meant a lot to me taught me this important lesson about how to take care of yourself when you're part of a rebellion. I did appreciate that. I thought that was nice.
I like Vel like becoming more mature and like, she's still alive by the end. Again, I love when a woman survives to the end of the series.
We do love to see it.
You love to see it. I think the Cinta death was the weakest thing in the show, because like when Evan and I were watching it, you could sense that it was coming and you knew exactly which of them was going to die. And it was like, yeah, this is just bad writing. Sorry. So yes, I was also disappointed that like, and maybe it's because they had to condense from 5 seasons to 2, and maybe it would have had more like weight and felt less less cheap, I guess, if there had been more episodes leading up to it or like setting the stage for that. Like Senta like mentioned some like health thing that happened, or like she had an issue and was pretty much isolated, and Vel had no idea. Like we have no idea what that's about, and I don't know. All of that was a little bit. It was not the best part of the show.
All right, we talked a little bit about Partagaz, and I think that the ISB storyline and seeing him go toe-to-toe with Krennic, and ultimately the ISB kind of like losing favor in the Empire because they let Clea escape, they let the intel get away. I thought that was a really interesting kind of framing for Partagaz, who has been this man in charge for so long, and then Krennic shows up, and all of a sudden the ISB is kind of on the back foot. It was an interesting way of refreshing that Imperial power dynamic, but I'm curious what the two of you thought of Krennic in the season, how he compares to where he's going to end up in Rogue One, and some of his scenes, whether it's, you know, interrogating Dedra or having that argument with Mon at Skulden's Gallery. What did you think of the way that they use Krennic in this season?
I thought he was, like, extra creepy. I didn't remember him being this, like, I need to rewatch Rogue One. It felt like, especially when he was talking to Dedra, like, I did not like him. And I know he's the bad guy, but it was like he was doing extra to be icky. I realize this is not the most sophisticated take of all time. This is my gut reaction.
I did think it was interesting that he was more... He had a lot more authority at this point than he does in Rogue One. And I can't quite explain that, because for most of Rogue One, things are kind of on track, and like there are some security breaches in that movie, but that's towards the end mostly. Except I guess for the pilot guy who gets away. But like, I don't understand why Krennic is so much more in the Emperor's favor in this show in season two, and more of a terror walking around than he seems to be in the first part of Rogue One. But I did think that bringing him in was a nice way to kind of shake up the dynamic. And Ben Mendelsohn is great as Krennic in season two.
Having just watched Rogue One, it wasn't inconsistent to me.
He's a creep in that one, or
he's a creep in that. But I'm talking about like the power dynamic. Because in Rogue One, we see him in comparison to creepy zombified Moff Tarkin. Which is the guy underneath Darth Vader. And then we see him in comparison to Darth Vader. So it makes sense that he is not of the same level of power that he is in Andor. Like, we don't see him in comparison to other underlings in Rogue One. We see him in comparison to the two most powerful men in the Empire other than the Emperor. But I mean, I have really nothing to add other than, he was great, he was interesting, he was creepy. I thought he was a great addition, and Ben Mendelsohn was wonderful.
All right, let's do a quick lightning round here. Everybody can shout out a few of your favorite things or the most interesting things or maybe some other things that are still making you mad from season two. Grace, start us off.
I really loved the costumes. That's probably the only thing that I didn't get to talk about in full, although I mentioned Mon's costumes. But the costumes just in general, so great. I loved seeing... Yavin as not just a rebel base, but as a home, and seeing where people lived there. And I really enjoyed Willman's arc this season, and seeing him become a rebel, and not just become a rebel, but like mature into a grown man. I thought that was really lovely. So those were the other things I liked.
I also really loved the costumes. I also really loved Mon Mothma dancing. Gorman, one thing I really appreciated was like the vibe was very much Nazi occupation of Paris. And I thought kind of leaning into history with the costuming and the like aesthetic was a good way to like ground the show in real history, which I know they wanted to do. I don't know. I just think Lana Young is going to be sticking with me for a long time. He did deserve better. We know it was possible to get off of Coruscant. There was no reason for Luthen to do that, but it's okay. I liked the show mostly.
Yeah, I think there's so much in Gorman that we didn't get to, but just like a few things. So the parallels between the meeting that Krennic has where they're planning what to do about Gorman and the Wannsee conference from World War II where the Nazis planned the final solution in the Holocaust. I mean, there's some really stark comparisons there in terms of like propaganda and we're going to dehumanize these people and we're going to create a permission structure basically for other people to look the other way and say they deserve it and they think they're better than us, so we don't really care what happens to them. That was really, really gripping. We didn't talk about this, which I'm kind of surprised by, but the media, the portrayal of journalists as aiding and abetting the Empire and supporting the Imperial propaganda line on Gorman, everything from like you know, the scenes where Partagaz will say something and then a reporter will say the exact same thing in the next scene. Like, there's a moment where Cyril watches it happen, and just the way that we use the media here to spoon feed these lies to the Imperial public. The TV show Good Morning Coruscant, I would love to see a web series of just those two people talking about Coruscanti fashion and parties and all that stuff. What else? Oh, just the changes in Yavin. So from the first story arc that obviously we all kind of didn't like Cassian just getting stuck there. But the lesson for me was this is a group of rebels that are ready to tear each other apart. Yavin is a jungle. These people are not professional. And then ending up where we end up at the end of the show with Yavin and a really professional organization. I thought that was great. The use of K2SO was sparing and good, so I really appreciate that they didn't try to make that last story arc the K2SO show. The production design, we've got a shout out. In addition to the camera work and the pacing, the sets and costumes were phenomenal, especially at the wedding and on Coruscant. And they did have some light moments, some funny moments. Everybody's using that picture of Cyril lying on his bed as a meme, and that feels very relatable. But then even things like the disco droid at the wedding, they were able to infuse these little fun moments into the show to make it feel lived in. And then the last thing I'll say is, you know, we briefly mentioned the farming planet and the sort of the immigration allegory there. I appreciate that they found a way to touch on that because it is such an important theme in contemporary America and the world, and tying that in and explaining it in a way that makes sense for this Star Wars world with what the Empire was doing. It didn't feel forced in. It felt very natural that kind of thing would be happening. I really appreciated that they were willing to touch on a theme like that, in addition to everything with Gorman in terms of the persecution and scapegoating and the disinformation and all that stuff. I really think that Andor did a great job of taking on some of these political themes head on in a way that I think that's going to be a big part of the show's legacy. But maybe that would be a good place to end things is a comment from each of us perhaps on season two, but then Andor as a whole. I mean, this is it for the show. So what does Andor mean to you and what will you remember about Andor?
I think I will probably remember the first season and escaping from the prison the most. And I'm going to try to remember the good parts of Andor more so than the nihilism and moral relativism. But that's what's sticking with me right now after watching the very last episode.
I am mostly also going to always remember and love season one. And the parts of season two that I really did appreciate. I think the Gorman Massacre was so, so well done. I think that season one was superior, and frankly, I could have only had a season one. I don't think I needed a season two. But I think it's definitely my favorite live action Star Wars show. And what I really appreciated about it was that it pushed the button of what Star Wars could be. And I think it towed the line between nihilism and hope. And I think, as Haley said, maybe it fell too much on the nihilism side in season two. But I loved how it made Star Wars grown up, but not like plotting or PLDDING, not POL or PLOTTING. But it didn't make it boring adult. It made it smart, complex adult. And I really loved seeing my Star Wars be grown up in this way while also introducing such fascinating themes, and then having really wonderful acting and set and production design and all of that.
Yeah, I think for me it is redefining what Star Wars can be in terms of the themes that it touches on and how forthrightly it addresses some really serious adult topics, but without being like, you know, too dark and too oppressively grim. And then adding that texture to what a rebellion is, how it forms, who is part of it. They're not all going to be friends and sunshine and rainbows. People are going to butt heads. People see the rebellion as different things, and they see different paths to victory. And that's not something that we had seen before in Star Wars in any level of detail. And Andor, really, for me, the legacy of the show is laying out the complexity of building a movement like this with people like Luthen and Mon and Saw and everybody having a role to play. And through that, showing that this is so much harder than it feels in A New Hope. And it feels difficult in A New Hope. But watching Luke blow up the Death Star, you have a real appreciation, thanks to Andor, for everything that led up to that moment. And in a very visceral way, how this movement is built on the backs of a ton of ordinary people. From the bellhop at the hotel to Lonnie, all the way to Cassian. This is a movement of people who are just fighting for a cause. And Andor did, in my opinion, a really fantastic job of delivering that message. All right, that's going to do it for our Andor Season 2 review show. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com or reach out to us on X and Blue Sky. We've got links to our social media platforms in the show notes. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. And as always, for legal purposes, we want to tell you all Star Wars music and sound effects, that's the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, that's hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.